Today, I wanted to talk about privilege. And it's a topic that I wrestle with a lot of my life, I guess, in a theoretical way, being born in the United States, being white, being even tall gives me advantages that others don't have, and obligations that others don't have, like, would you please reach that for me? But I wanted to look at privilege in how it functions, I guess, and how to embrace it in a way that, for example, one of the vows we take, I vow to save all sentient beings. If you're a person of privilege, how do you save all sentient beings? And the Buddha was born Siddhartha Gautama, and he was born in a privileged family. The story goes that his parents didn't want him to see what the rest of the world looked like, and so he benefited from being born of good seed genetically, being in the midst of opulence, which is the result of much labor by numerous beings. And so he had a lot to, a lot of benefits when he began. And then he asked his tender, I think, and said, you know, what's out there? Take me for a ride. He says, well, I can't do that. You know, I can't be taking you out there. I'm under orders. He says, take me out there. Come on. I won't tell anybody. So he went out. And instead of seeing all of the opulence and the fruit of everybody's labor, he saw how it was falling apart, how it naturally falls apart in sickness, in disease of many kinds, in people dying and death. And it was like a real experience for him that must have touched his heart in some way, that he said, I got to figure this out. And he just embarked on his journey. And for the last 40 years of his journey, he sufficed with a robe and a bowl. It was pretty simple. Of course, he begged for his food, so he asked for it, and he received it and felt gratitude for it, and it was that he and his Sangha received huge quantities of goods to sustain them. They were fed, they were housed where they needed to be, they were invited places. But fundamentally, he saw that it didn't require much more than a robe and a bowl to survive. Now, I wanted to also bring in another topic that I'll see if I can make this work too. And that is on the, when the Buddha was alive, you know, there were not many rules. There were no rules when he started, except probably to be kind to other people. But there were no long lists of rules and regulations by which to function by, which arose later when the need arose. And like Kira Chikoji, were there are just a few of us that live here, like under 10 right now. And so the rules we have are quite simple. But on a similar size plot of land up in Marin County on Green Gulch, there are 60 people that live full-time, that part of the San Francisco Zen Center. And I think they have a few more rules than we do. So rules arise as the need does. But one of the notions in Buddhism is that didn't arise with Buddha, it arose later. It's called a trikaya. It's the Dharmakaya, the Sambhokaya, the Nirmanakaya. And the Dharmakaya is considered the radiant body, the radiance of the universe. So I guess our sun could be considered quite radiant and just unending radiance. The Sambhokaya has been defined as the bliss body. And I think Carl Jung might have a helpful insight into what the Sambhokaya is. He calls it the matrix of archetypes or structural patterns. And, you know, there are a lot of different archetypes that Carl Jung pointed out, and actually there's probably an unending list of archetypes that actually exist. But we all manifest different archetypes at different times. And one of the archetypes is as a child. One of the archetypes is as a king or a queen. So each of us have times where we manifest, we embody some of these archetypes, but it's a matrix of archetypes. And my background's in geology, so a matrix in geology is what kind of, like a matrix in a conglomerate is where you have all these fine-grained materials that encase other larger rocks. And so a matrix of archetypes or structural patterns to me would indicate that there are all these things coming together and they're all happening. And the structural patterns are some things that many of us study and work with, you know, whether you're a carpenter or working as a scientist, the structural patterns of the universe are pretty well known. You know, the densities of rock material, the elements of the periodic table, the law of gravity, which I want to point out still has not been proved yet. So it's a theory, one of the many unproved theories that we take for granted. So there's the radiance, and then there are the archetypes and structural patterns that then manifest in the Nirmanakaya, which is often, when we chant it, it's Shakyamuni Buddha. But it's, I see it as all things, all people, is the Nirmanakaya, the manifestation of the archetypes and the structural patterns manifest, so that's what we see. And it all comes from the original radiance. So that's the Trikaya, Dharmakaya, Sambhokaya, Nirmanakaya. So privilege, how does that fit in with all this? I think, you know, one of the manifestations of privilege for me is that I recognize, and not that I feel embarrassed about it at all, but it's something that I don't take advantage of like a lot of people do. When you have privileges, a lot of people take full advantage of the privileges they have to get as far and as fast to the top or where they're heading as possible with those privileges. The problem arises is when we encounter those that may not have those privileges. And for example, when I was born a healthy baby with a pleasant demeanor, with reasonable intelligence, so my parents liked me. They took good care of me because I was probably a nice young one to take care of. And not all people have that. They are born with a cranky attitude, with maybe an intelligence that requires special tending. It might require care for different health issues. And so those have a harder time in with their life. And so what I wanted to look at were unearned privileges. Because as a white man, one of the privileges I have is I don't have to pay attention to the privileges I have. I just use them. I don't have to be aware of them. I don't have to acknowledge them. I don't have to consider what it means. I can just make full use of it. So, whereas there are other people who the privilege of being white is not what they have. They have the privilege of being black or of color. And so where they embark into a circumstance, they get to feel what that's like. And it's probably on their mind a lot, unless they're among their own people. And one of the things I noticed, and I don't know if others here have had this experience, but I know many people of color, and one of the things that often happens when I'm addressed by them, at least initially, is they call me sir. Now, that's not something I do to other people. I don't call them sir very often. I don't think I do. It's not something I've trained myself to do, and I wasn't in the military, whereas if you've been in the military, I think that's one of the trainings that you get. But I see that as kind of a mechanism by which they survive better, because then it, when they are recognized as being respectful, they are respected in return. And of course, we get to experience that too. So there's this researcher at Berkeley who has been studying, his group of people have been studying privilege for a while, and maybe some of you have encountered this recently because it's been around in the media. But he, one study, they were watching people in crosswalks and the behaviors of drivers who were supposed to stop, where, you know, as soon as a person steps into a crosswalk, you're supposed to stop. And they found that 90% of the drivers stopped when somebody stepped into a crosswalk. However, drivers of BMWs, Mercedes, and Porsches were anywhere from 3 to 4 times more likely to break the law and not stop than drivers of less expensive cars. Then they did another study where They interviewed people coming into their circumstance, their office. They wanted to interview them, and they asked them about their profile, their education, how much money they make, some more on their background. And then the woman at the desk had this bowl of candy, and she said, "Here, this bowl of candy is for children in another study we're doing, but you're welcome to have some candy." And they found those of wealth took twice as much candy as those of low means. Sounds like there's some entitlement there. They did another study where they had a there was a game where they worked to earn credits to win a $50 cash prize, and they found that those making $150,000 to $200,000 a year were, I think it was four times as likely to cheat on this test than those that made, say, $15,000 a year. So it's more likely for a white man to be arrogant and rude and maybe not even be aware of it than because he's unaware, he's not paying attention to the unearned gifts that he has. Now, there are earned gifts, too, that we get, like maybe the degree we have and the position we have in the company we work in. And I got a good position, and I got a good education, so... But as far as wanting to climb to the top and all that, it's not something that I care about, and even I don't even really notice too much about, because it's for some reason it just wasn't on a driving force for me. But like a lot of people, when they go into a room with a lot of other people where they're going to have a meeting, this might be something that some of you can relate with, is when you scan the room, you look for who the bull moose is in the room. Who's in charge? And I go into a room and I look for a seat. And I actually look for a soft zone. So I look for the soft zone in the room to be in. And I just kind of feel it and then go, and it's usually in a corner. But there are others that go for that. You know, competition is pretty fun, you know, to engage in. So I guess in my current practice in Buddhism, my current life practice, I want to better understand how I relate with aspects of race, class, gender, and ideology. I go visit my mom, and she says, "There isn't a good Republican that I know of." So she's already gotten that all blocked off. It's like, ah, geez, you know. So how do you kind of open that up? One of the ways to do it is to meditate. And when you come to meditate, and of course there are dozens and dozens of ways, different kinds of meditation, different methods of concentration. But one of the things that naturally happens, I think, and no matter which method you use, is your mind begins to go off what your mantra is or what your practice is, like ours is paying attention to our breath. And thoughts arise and we are able to reflect on our lives and what's important in our lives, what bothers us in our life. And so that practice of witnessing what arises, witnessing what our thinking is, instead of just thinking it, like we get to witness our thinking in a way that's slightly separate from the thinking. And then we get into the middle of it, and after a while it's like, oh my God, I've been thinking about this for the last 5 or 10 minutes. Back to breath. But you have a chance to see how my brain is functioning, what issues crop up, what totally off-the-wall stuff comes into my head, and it's like, where does this come from? So I think in meditation is a good place to examine our lives and the gifts that we've received, and inevitably, when I examine what I have, deep gratitude arises. This feeling of like, wow, am I lucky? I got a place to sleep. I got food to eat. I've got a job. I have income. I can take care of my family, my other interests. I've got a body, a physical body, and the sensations in the body are just wonderful to have. And I gotta die. I wanna live. I wanna experience. I wanna taste. I wanna smell. And I think that's why it's called the bliss body. The Sambhogakaya Buddha is the bliss body of all these archetypes and all these structural patterns. It's like, when you appreciate it, it's like, wow, I'm in bliss. It's pretty sweet. So I hope anybody else who's studying the Trikaya might give me some response to that, because maybe I'm wrong about what the bliss body is. But anyway, that's what I'm proposing today. There is a journalism professor, University of Texas, a guy named Robert Jensen, who wrote, "The ultimate white privilege is the privilege to acknowledge that you have unearned privilege, but can ignore what it means." White privilege is not something I get to decide whether I want to keep. I will carry this privilege with me until the day white supremacy is erased from this society. So he posted this interesting essay on privilege, and he said he was visited by an elderly white man, or elderly black man, who he struck up conversation with, and the elderly black man said, "Good thing to keep an eye on that white privilege. Be honest about it, and don't forget to pay attention to those without the privilege." So don't forget those without the privilege. And so, we chant, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And one of the things that I always thought about it was like, okay, form. And then there's, with a form gone, there's the empty space where that form was. It's like the shadow or the absence of the mass and the material. There's kind of the form and then the shape of the form with the substance gone. And that's hard to imagine, just as I think privilege and the absence of privilege. It's hard to see that without some work. Another form of the Sambhogaya structural pattern that we have in our society are labor and capital. And in 1861, Abraham Lincoln gave an inaugural address. He actually wrote it out and sent it to Congress, mailed it to Congress or had it delivered to Congress. And it wasn't until later that they actually had speeches, the State of the Union speeches. But in that, in his address, it was at a time when 11 states had already seceded from the Union. And I think the Union Army had lost at Bull Run and was in complete disarray. But he tackled one of the fundamental issues of that time, which I think might still be relevant, and that is looking at labor and looking at capital. And this is what he wrote. Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior to capital and deserves much the higher consideration. And at that time, there were mostly, I think in our country, there were mostly family businesses, family farms, family enterprises. So it was families that were planting the seeds, growing the crops, harvesting, and even maybe getting help transporting the goods to the market. But then there were those that were, the Industrial Revolution had begun, there were plenty of plantations, so that there were those that had this view of the system, which he also wrote this. He said, "It is assumed that labor is available only in connection with capital, that nobody labors unless somebody else owning capital somehow by the use of it induces him to labor. The next assumption is that capital should hire laborers and thus induce them to work by their own consent, or to buy them and drive them to it without their consent." And at that time, people were either, if they were in the employ of those with the capital, they were either laborers for life or they were slaves for life. And so he wanted to break apart those assumptions. He wanted it to be looked at. And I guess, to me, that's a relevant thing to still do. He says, "Capital has its rights which are as worthy of protection as any other rights. There is a relation between labor and capital producing mutual benefits. The error is in assuming that the whole labor of community exists within that relation, and that a few men own capital and that few avoid labor themselves." So he's suggesting labor should have higher consideration than capital. And maybe I'm mixing too much in here, but it's like, how do these distinctions that we make and we hold on to how does it affect other beings and the world. So our actions and the fruits of our actions exist in context, in different kinds of context. They exist in context of the sun and the moon and the rest of the universe. They exist in relation to the earth, sea, and the sky. They exist in context with our communities that we're in the midst of. There are those that only want to inhale and acquire. And it is also essential to not suffocate, so we must exhale. And pay attention to that aspect of our life. So, the Buddha had his essentials. He had his robe, he had his bowl. And he had enormous gratitude for all the things that allowed him to survive and a Sangha to survive. And as that elderly black man said, don't forget to pay attention to the folks who live without privilege. As we experience our life and our death, can we gratefully acknowledge all of life, the poor and the rich, the sick and the healthy, the old and the young? And I think this is the gift of the Buddha, is to appreciate all of it. And I want to conclude with a poem by Uchiyama Roshi, who spent a long time dying and spent a lot of time writing poetry about dying. Mm-hmm. And one of his poems is this. Though poor, never poor. Though sick, never sick. Though aging, never aging. Though dying, never dying. Reality prior to division, reality prior to division, herein lies unlimited depth. Thank you. So the lunch bell rang, but I'd like to entertain a few comments or questions or criticisms or whatever people might have.
Criticism?
Yes, please. Bree.
Thank you, Dad. That was rich. Really rich. And for me, it just brought to mind my love of feminism and some of the things that we've talked about, you know, Breanne Eisler's work in particular. And one of the things that I think has been really formative in shaping privilege, and the fact that 65%, that, you know, like disproportionately women over 65 have a lot of poverty in this country after caring for their children, and so the somehow the relegation of the productive realm receiving that capital and that compensation, and the reproductive realm, you know, basically being a dead zero in terms of income, I think really shaped and has continued to inform the privilege that exists and the disparity, the gender disparity that exists as well. And so I really appreciated what was said about, you know, labor and capital, because if that notion of labor can be expanded to include all of the labor of caring and caregiving and child rearing, you know, that can be kind of overturned and there can be more abundance available for everyone. And of course, the most significant piece for all this for me is that is this idea that the status of women is a greater indicator of a country's economic long-term prosperity than the GDP. And so, you know, in the study of cultures around the world where peace has really prevailed, the one thing that those cultures have largely held in common is that they've been goddess-worshipping cultures. And so really bringing in the feminine seems to also bring in this this care for all beings and peace in general.
Yeah, the labor of bearing a child and it, taking care of its development, and then it becomes a taxpayer that contribute and a laborer in the greater social system. I mean, man, they should get at least 1% of everything they produce, right? And so, anyway, yeah. Thank you.
Pension.
What?
Pension.
A pension?
Yeah. Your mother.
Hell yeah.
I have to say, though, in defense, I tend to see it as a slightly bigger, that I don't see this associated purely to gender. Maternal, specifically.
What's your point?
Well, there seemed to be an emphasis on gender, and I come back to emptiness a little, interdependent connection to everything, and the maternal archetype, if you will, is not gender-bound.
Archetype is not gender-bound?
Maternal archetype is not gender-bound.
It can be male or female.
It is.
Yeah.
I believe.
Yeah. Yes, Anna.
I agree that gender is fluid, but there has to be acknowledgement of sexual difference and a privilege in that.
For sure.
I'm also saying that because I recently came back from Texas, and it blew my mind as to what's happening there.
Texas?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Very, very heartbreaking.
Yes, Marco.
As coming from Europe, I mean, to me, I saw big differences in terms of privileges, like in education, for example, because to me it was obvious that everyone has access to any lower and higher education in Europe. You can go to university almost for free. But here, you need to, you know, commit, once you have a child, I mean, you have to start thinking about that, because apparently it's a big issue. You need lots of money. And similarly also for the healthcare. I was used to, you know, in Europe to have a social assistance where you don't have to worry about that for your entire life. While here, I was impressed, for example, by the fact that if you get sick, you lose your job, so you lose your health insurance, or you might even die for that. And that was a problem that I never even thought, you know, in my entire life. For me, it was perception. You get sick, you get to the hospital. That's it. Mm-hmm. So, and I believe it's just the system, because it's so that you can have a different system, it's just easy to do it. You know, and sometimes I'm still shocked about that. And pension is another issue, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these things where you really have to kind of be in a survival mode somehow here more than in Europe. That's my impression. And this makes me thinking about privileges that I have in Europe that I was assuming kind of obvious, but they're not.
Yeah, in Buddhism, you know, we're after enlightenment, but some people go for their own personal enlightenment, and some go for helping all other beings become enlightened before they are. And I think that kind of notion is healthy for our social contract, you know, to how do we bring everybody along as I'm a part of a bigger organism, a civilization of over 6 billion parts. And how do we take care of that? Do we have to fight each other? What do we do? What's our role? What's our part? What can we do to make it so that all of us make this amazing civilization that we got? So that's what I think about and struggle with, and I also have it's become less theoretical. You can have your ideology going around your head that you keep. That's what it is. But then it has to meet reality somewhere, whether on the job site. I work on a construction job site, so I meet people that are laborers, that are truck drivers, concrete finishers, rebar guys, and they work hard. They got families. They're multi-ethnic, and it's just interesting to see the variety of attitudes, the variety of kinds of happiness that they have. And so it's, you know, their labor is what is making this phenomenal station we're building downtown San Francisco. And yet the games that are played by the companies that are run, that hire these guys, you know, they're on kind of a different level, and it's not just getting the work done, but it's like, how can we maximize our profits in this? And so there's an exchange that goes back and forth, and what's right, what's wrong, what is it at the end of the day? What is the real reality of it all? I mean, it's something that, for me, it's not something I can say, yeah, this is right and this is wrong. It's like, there's all this consideration to have, but how to keep people happy that like to keep coming to work, and they like to and keep their families going. It's just it's nice to be part of the mix, not just, you know, in a theoretical sense thinking about it here at a Buddhist retreat center, but to actually take it, wear my hard hat and vest, and go out onto a project and meet it. Any other comments? Yes?
I really like this one, the privilege, especially the concept of making sure that you're aware of it, that you pay attention to it. Because I was raised in Salt Lake City as mm-hmm. Mormon, mm-hmm. and it's a very enclosed social structure there. There are very few minorities, and I also like how feminism is brought into this, because it's also a very patriarchal society. So it's, and when you're raised as a child in that kind of an environment, you don't pay attention to, you know, as a white, I'm also tall as well, white man, I'm tall, and you just don't pay attention to all the privilege that you really have. And so it's one thing that I've been more mindful of ever since I've left Utah. So
and the diversity. How
oh, I loved it.
Isn't that nice? It's just, that's one of the really fun things about this place. And even in L.A., you know, where there are like 150 different languages spoken at car dealerships. Wow. So I get on the freeway at 5:30 in the morning, and it's like, is it a Persian person or a Latino or African-American or a white guy? Or who is it that's there? And just the sometimes the feel of the traffic, you can actually feel it's different by I'm trying to get into the next lane and somebody actually gives me an opening. You can feel them giving you an opening. It's like, wow, this is L.A. I thought it was competitive out here. I thought, you know, I had to shove my way into the next lane. But no, it's like there's some generosity exhibited even in that context. So it's pretty fun. Yes?
I enjoyed the reminder of what the Buddha's possessions were. Also heard when Gandhi died, he had like three items to his name, his glasses and two other small things like that. Mm-hmm. It never ceases to amaze me how like the more people earn, the more their expenses rise along with it,
mm-hmm.
no matter where you are, how much or how little you make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And last few years, it's really impacted me because it just seems like a rat race. It seems like when is enough enough? You know, what's the point of making more just to have more? And it's a good reminder of how little we really need.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. There was one fellow who lived here temporarily, a kid named Andy, who said, you know, you ask people, how much more do they need? And inevitably, they just need a little more. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter where you are on the economic scale. Oh, I just need a little more. I need a $10. I need $102 million. What is it going to be? And yeah, it's kind of nice to know that it can be a robe and a bowl or the three things that Gandhi had. Yeah. Yes, Anna.
You know, it's funny because I'll make this short, but there's certain types of privilege. So one becomes, it seems that one from hearing, one becomes aware of one's privilege when they're in contact with an other without privilege. And there's certain types of privilege that have identity, obvious identity with skin color and different sex. And then there's certain type of privilege that we can't see. And it really blows my mind, like, when I go out every day, like, just in reality, like, everyone assumes I'm heterosexual off the bat. Or, like, or have this... And it's interesting. It's like... And then it turns that I assume that everyone is heterosexual. And that's, like, normative of it. But... And that's interesting to think of, like, differences in identity and presentation, the performance of it. The gender is just performance. This and same thing with class. It's just a performance. Just an animus, mask.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you.